This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the January 1st issue of The New Yorker magazine, my guest Richard Barnett wrote an article titled Reflections After the Cold War. He speculated on what the dramatic changes in the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc may mean for U.S. foreign and domestic policy. Barnett is the co-founder of the think tank, the Institute for Policy Studies. He's written more than 10 books and many articles on the Cold War, arms control, and U.S. foreign policy. His new book, The Rocket's Red Glare, is an historical analysis of the struggle between American presidents and the American people over control of the decision to go to war. This week, the Soviet Communist Party voted to relinquish its monopoly and allow a multi-party system. I asked Barnett what he thinks the immediate effects will be in the Soviet Union.
The immediate effect is certainly to strengthen Gorbachev's position, because this is a rather remarkable political feat that he was able to accomplish. I think it will continue the ferment in the Soviet Union and open up real possibility of change. It makes the possibility of real change much more credible to the Soviet people, and that I think is very encouraging.
Do you think that there'll be any short-term effects on day-to-day life for Soviets?
I think there will in a matter of months, certainly. That is, that if in fact it leads, as I hope and think it will, to a much more vibrant political life, it will encourage innovation and people being willing to step forward to come up with ideas for how to solve some of the political and particularly economic problems at the local levels. One of the great problems with the Soviet system, one reason why it was so paralyzed and unmovable, was that people were frightened to be creative and to be innovative. And this, I think, at least opens up some possibility that that can happen. I don't want to overestimate the changes or be Pollyannish. The problems of conversion of that system into something that can work and particularly work democratically are very great, as you know.
In a recent edition of The New Yorker magazine, you had an article about the ending of the Cold War, and you wrote that the Cold War has been the organizing principle of U.S. strategy. What are some of the U.S. policies that you think might be obsolete now as we face the end of the Cold War?
Well, I think everything has to be rethought. Justice within the Soviet Union, everything seems to be up for reexamination and a new look. I think this is true about U.S. foreign policy. Our foreign policy was really built on four pillars: the NATO alliance, nuclear deterrence, the idea that we would have to use military power in the Third World to prevent Soviet expansion and development of nationalist regimes that were against American interests, and the fourth was the world of Bretton Woods, the assumptions behind the international economic order, the international monetary order. All of these things were really put together from between the years 1949-48 and 54. The world now has changed in so many ways that each one of these has to be looked at. For example, up until a few weeks ago, there were certain bits of conventional wisdom that were not challenged anywhere. One of them was that German reunification was really impossible, and that really nobody wanted it, not even the Germans themselves, not even the West Germans, and certainly the Soviet Union would never allow it. Now, I think it is much safer to say that German reunification is practically inevitable.
Let me ask you, in the pillars that you see our foreign policy having been based on, you mentioned the importance of the NATO alliance, the importance of nuclear deterrence, the importance of having military power in the third world to end Soviet expansion. As the Cold War seems to end, do you think that we need to be rethinking the meaning of national security?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. In fact, I would argue that the end of the Cold War has come about because there has been a rethinking of national security. I think you see this quite clearly in Gorbachev's thinking. That is, in order to get to where he has come, he had to revise a very basic tenet of Soviet thinking. Two of them, really. One was that war from the West was not only possible, but over the long run, historical run, probable. And the second was that war, if it comes, has to be fought on non-Russian soil. The lesson of World War II. And that's the reason, I think, that the Soviets believed for so many years that the control of Eastern Europe, the domination and occupation of Eastern Europe, was essential to the security, so that the war would be fought there and not on their own territory. They've clearly rethought both ideas. One, that the notion of the war, which is the focus of our defense policy and their defense policy, is not very likely and is far from the most serious threat, security threat, facing the world. Economic problems are much greater. Environmental problems that were swept under the rug for so long are much greater. And therefore, I think he came to the conclusion that the risks of trying to hold on to an Eastern Europe were greater than the risks of opening it up and essentially letting it go. Now, I think the United States' basic military strategy is also focused on the war in Europe, and the nuclear deterrence, this very arcane, almost theological discipline where people are imagining how you deter future wars. All that was focused on Europe.
Well, if national security were no longer defined through nuclear deterrence and through military power to end Soviet expansion, what do you think the priorities in national security should be?
Well, I'm not suggesting that military power doesn't have a role to play. There are military threats and potential military threats, and the military balance is a problem. But the major problems facing the United States today are both economic and environmental. That is, the danger of the environmental degradation of the planet and the growing body of knowledge that we have got to take very rapid and comprehensive action to prevent that ecological disaster. That, it seems to me, is an absolute priority. The second priority is rethinking the relationship of the United States to the world economy. While we were fighting the Cold War, the United States, I think, has suffered severely by, as indeed has the Soviet Union, by neglecting the non-military aspects of security. That is, our industrial base, our educational system. We are not in a position to compete in a world economy. We're getting more dependent on that economy, and we have less control over it.
Richard Barnett is my guest, and he's a senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, a think tank that he co-founded. He's the author of many books on U.S. foreign policy, and his latest is called The Rocket's Red Glare, When America Goes to War. Do you really think the Cold War is over? I mean, the president, for instance, has been warning that we shouldn't get lulled into complacency. What's to prevent reversals in all the changes that we're seeing? How permanent can we be sure these changes are going to be?
Well, no changes are permanent, but I do not think we're going to go back to the Cold War. I don't think history will slip back. The Soviet Union made its moves to end the policies of from Stalin through Chernenko, because of their manifest failure. Nobody denies that those policies failed. They failed. They caused the isolation of the Soviet Union in the world, and they caused the deterioration of their economy and the loss of faith in the political system and in the social system. And that's a reality that any future Soviet leader will have to deal with. So I don't think it's possible to reinvent the Cold War. At the same time, I think the world is entering into a very dangerous time and a potentially one that has lots of potentialities for tragedy, which is why the need for rethinking policy and moving rapidly in collaboration with other nations of the world to reestablish a new world security order is so essential.
Can you be more specific about the potential dangers that you think we face?
Well, I think that there is a possibility that the Soviet Union might really fall apart, that the kinds of tension and civil war, really, that we've seen in Azerbaijan and Georgia, that this could multiply, could increase, if, in fact, Gorbachev is unable to solve the basic economic problems. And it is a situation in which there are 25,000 nuclear weapons.
Back in 89, you had an op-ed piece in the L.A. Times, and you wrote, "The Cold War is over. The winner is Japan." You want to explain that?
Yes. I think I'd amend it and say that the winner is Japan and Germany. That is, that the nations that were defeated in World War II and disarmed and helped to industrial recovery by the United States and by the other allied nations to some extent, but mostly the United States, really achieved the best record of security in the post-war period, that both the superpowers, so-called, the United States and the Soviet Union, having spent astronomical amounts on the military, ended up less secure than they were when the Cold War began. Japan and Germany are able to outcompete the United States in no small measure because they developed economic policies that made for greater savings, more emphasis on education, more concern about the innovation of products, and their scientific and engineering talent the priority for using that was the civilian market, whereas in the United States and in the Soviet Union, it went to the military. In the Soviet Union, military operations, military technology was the most developed, sometimes the only thing that worked. They would often have to get the army to do things that couldn't be done in the civilian economy. And in the United States, we've more than half of our scientists and engineers for a very long period were working directly or indirectly for the military, and that had terrible costs.
Well, you've also predicted that there might be a second Cold War, and the second one might be with Japan.
Yes, well, the United States-Japanese relations, in my view, is our single most serious problem, because we have organized ourselves, and the Japanese have organized themselves, in such a way as to be on a collision course. They need desperately to export, and so also do we, to much to the same markets. And the relationship is, in a way, more related to more volatile, concern to the average American than the relationship with the Soviet Union, which, in a way, concerned strategists and policymakers. But with Japan, the impact of Japan is felt on the average American. It has a direct impact on the standard of living. And we're already beginning to see what I think is a very alarming increase in hostility to Japan. And the same in Japan. I mean, we talk about Japan bashing here. America bashing is worse. A recent book by a politician and a leading industrialist, Morita of Sony, The Japan That Can Say No, is a demeaning and rather hostile book. The trouble with the book is that some of what it says is true. That is, it is taking the United States to task for misarranging for not arranging our affairs in a way that makes sense from our own interests. And I think they're true. But it's a lot easier for the United States and for most countries to blame some foreign antagonist than to do the hard work of looking at ourselves and coming up with policies that would take us out of our present crisis.
You have a new book on a related subject, and your book, The Rocket's Red Glare, is about the power of presidents and the power of citizens in determining foreign policy, specifically in determining whether we're going to go to war or not. Why did you look at this subject?
I did because I am concerned why is it that the United States appears now to have such difficulty adapting to new opportunities and new dangers. And I wanted to look at the argument that observers of the American scene have made really since the beginning of our country, starting with de Tocqueville in 1830, that democracy and foreign policy just don't fit. That a democracy, he said, is decidedly inferior as far as conducting foreign policy. And I was interested to see what difference has it really made to the United States that we're a democracy? What difference, if any, have the people made?
You reach a conclusion which really surprises me, which is that the power of the people, the power of public opinion over foreign policy has grown in recent years.
It has grown, I believe, because, and it's a consequence of the nuclear weapons and the Cold War. In the early part of our history, as shown in the book, presidents could pretty much conduct foreign policy on their own, except when we got into a big war. But since 1945, the United States has really been in a state of permanent mobilization. That's really what deterrence means. It's based on the idea that you have a permanent military establishment always ready for war. Once you do that, that means that you have permanent high taxes. It means that that you are constantly having to explain and sell the policy to the public. And the public becomes much more involved. And it is only in the post-war period that we have examples of public opinion actually turning policy around. Not only punishing presidents, as happened with Lyndon Johnson and Harry Truman in the Korean War, but changing the policy in the Korean War and on the Vietnam War.
So you think that since the power of public opinion has increased, that it's changed the president's job in a way to selling foreign policy to the public?
Yes, it's a problem because the more the president has to sell, the more the temptation is to oversell. And what we have seen is that later presidents get stuck with the consequences of what Dean Acheson once called the art of making things clearer than the truth, something you have to do to sell policy to the public, so that just as in the Second World War, when we were an ally of the Soviet Union, we turned Stalin into a Democrat. So in order to get support for the Cold War policy in the beginning, I think presidents exaggerated, not the deficiencies of the Soviet system. I think those were clear enough. But the idea that the Soviet Union was bent on world military conquest. And that was an idea that was very strongly hammered home, and I think ultimately made it harder to deal with the political problems that we face.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Appreciate your inviting me.
Richard Barnett is the co-founder of the Institute for Policy Studies, a think tank based in Washington, D.C. He's also the author of the new book, The Rocket's Red Glare, When America Goes to War. His recent article on the ending of the Cold War appeared in the January 1st issue of the New Yorker magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.